This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. It's a question as old as humanity itself, as old as the Garden of Eden, if you roll that way. Why, in a world full of good options, do people still do bad things? Why do people who haven't done anything wrong end up suffering, while those who use others for their own gain end up succeeding? And for heaven's sake, how do we explain a Hitler or a Stalin or an Idi Amin? How do we explain evil? Evil is the subject we're taking up today in our occasional excursion to philosophy. And joining us is Dr. Susanna Reinert of UMKC's Philosophy Department. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. Before we get to the problem at hand, maybe it would help to clarify something. Maybe it's just me, but these sure sound like religious questions we're talking about. What does it mean to talk about questions like the problem of evil as a philosopher?
That's a great question. And actually, there's a logical dimension to the problem as well. So theologians often, especially Western theologians, will have a conception on which God is a perfect being. And that entails that God is all-knowing, all-good, and all-powerful. And that seems to entail that God wouldn't allow evil, right? Because God would know about evil before it happens. God wouldn't want the evil to happen since God is all good. And God would have the power to prevent it. So it seems like we can just get a logical entailment from the conception of God to the claim that there wouldn't be any evil, but obviously there is evil in the world. So it looks like we actually have a logical contradiction between the conception of God as perfect and the existence of evil in the world. And it's when those logical questions come in that philosophers really pick up the subject and get interested.
Why do philosophers care whether there's a God at all? I don't mean that to be a flippant question. I mean, why is that an area of concern at all?
Well, philosophers are interested in the truth. They're interested in the nature of reality. They're interested in what's important in life. And whether or not God exists is really interesting, really important question about the nature of the world and how we should live our lives. So I'd say it's one of the prime areas for philosophers to be interested in.
Okay, so that's the fundamental question we're after today, this problem of evil. Let's sort of take apart the question a little bit and talk about the pieces of it. What is evil anyway? When we're talking about evil in this conversation, what do we mean?
Well, I don't think I can give you a strict definition, but perhaps the best way to approach this is to think about examples. Imagine these horrible things happen all the time, and an innocent child who burns to death in a house fire. That seems like a pretty clear example of a bad thing, something that it would be better if that didn't happen. And I don't think we need to have a really abstract definition of evil to get the judgment that, yeah, that's a bad thing.
So you're not just speaking of things that a person does to someone else.
It's
not just those evil people, but just the presence of bad things happening, even if they're accidents.
Exactly. So that includes accidents. It includes what's sometimes called natural evil, so hurricanes, tsunamis, earthquakes. Basically, the question that philosophers are interested in is the existence of this perfect being compatible with suffering and misfortune and all these things that we think a perfect being would prevent?
And nobody, I guess one of the questions I'd have is when we're talking about personal evil, sort of a Hitler or a Stalin, these names that always come up, that assumes that another person's understanding of the good is the right one. I mean, often a person does evil but doesn't think what they're doing is evil, right?
That's right. It's certainly the case that people do bad things believing that they're good. Sometimes I get this response in class that, well, evil, what's evil, what's not? This is just kind of subjective. It's just sort of an opinion or a taste. And I think that's an interesting view, but I do think it's a counterintuitive one. So there are some areas where we are happy to say that it's just a matter of opinion. So take a preference for ice cream, what kind of ice cream you like. Is licorice ice cream good or not? Maybe we'll have a dispute about that, but it seems plausible that it's just my opinion versus your opinion. There's no deep fact here. Right. There are other areas where it seems like, no, there really is an objective truth here. So math might be a good example. Is 2 plus 2 equal to 4? Well, you might think not, but you would be wrong, right?
There is a right and a wrong answer.
And so the question is, these claims about, an innocent child's burning to death, is this evil? Is that question like the ice cream question or like the math question? Is there an objective fact there? I think most people are inclined to say, no, when you really think about it, it's pretty obvious that's a bad thing. It's not sort of something that We certainly people might disagree, but if they disagreed, I think they'd be wrong. And I think this is particularly clear in examples of extreme atrocities. So the Holocaust, for example, I think most people would be inclined to say, yeah, that is clearly something evil. That's just as objectively true as 2 + 2 = 4.
Now, as we move toward a question that we can answer, what comes to mind for me is the title of a famous book by Rabbi Harold Kushner, the When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And it's often misquoted, that title, as Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. He purposely didn't title the book that because he didn't think he could answer that question. Is that the question, though, that we're trying to answer? Why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah, that's one way of phrasing it. The philosophers will typically focus, again, on the logical question. Is the existence of this perfect being compatible with bad things happening to good people? Of course, maybe you might not believe in God at all, in which case it's not so much a problem for you whether there's a compatibility there or not. But, a lot of us do have religious beliefs. A lot of people do. And it's, I think, an important question how to respond to this. And there are lots of really interesting and, I think, subtle responses that some believers have given to this problem, which we could delve into.
Well, let's delve into them. But first, let's invite our listeners to also help us delve into them. Yeah. Before the expert starts giving us some of the answers, let's hear what you think. How would you respond to the question of why there is evil or how it is compatible for bad things to happen alongside the existence of a good God or even a goodness in humanity or nature? How can you explain the persistence of evil? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. This is a philosophy conversation. You don't have to be an expert. Everybody's a philosopher. 235-2888. You can also email us. Our address is centralstandard@kcur.org. All right, Dr. Susanna Reinert of UMKC's Philosophy Department, let's get to some of the answers. How do we explain the persistence of evil alongside the presumed existence of a good God?
Right. Well, one interesting response here is to focus on an analogy with art. So imagine a painting that's really beautiful when you look at the whole painting. But we can imagine that if you were to zoom in on a particular tiny part of that painting and just look at that part might look really ugly. Maybe it's an ugly color or it has some other feature that is really not aesthetically pleasing. But nonetheless, it might be that that ugly piece is necessary for the painting as a whole to look beautiful. So the analogy there is, well, maybe the universe is like that. We only see a tiny piece of the universe. When we focus in on an individual event, it might look like a really evil and a really bad thing, but there's the possibility that from God's perspective, God can see the whole universe at once. It might be that that little piece that looks evil to us, given our limited perspective, would actually be necessary for the universe as a whole to be the best that it possibly could be.
But how is that a helpful answer to the question? I don't mean to be flippant
asking that.
I mean,
no.
Okay, so it makes sense to God or whomever, but that doesn't help me.
Right. Well, if you take that response, you have to be okay with a little bit of ignorance and a little bit of mystery and just have to think that somehow, even though you can't see it, somehow from God's perspective, things look beautiful or good. And I think here, this is best seen as a response to the logical problem that I was pointing out earlier, right? So some philosophers think that there's actually a logical incompatibility between the existence of God on the one hand and the fact of evil in the world on the other. Hmm. And if you think that small, isolated evils are actually necessary for the world to be the best possible world, then you've pointed out that there's not a logical incompatibility. Now, maybe I don't understand all the details about how that works, but at least it's not a logical incompatibility there.
Okay, so one way of reconciling it is at least to believe that this momentary suffering, this small human example, is just the small picture, but in the big picture, it really works out to be good.
Right. And another analogy might be, say you're a parent and you want to give your child a vaccine against a deadly and very painful disease. So the child may not understand what's going on, right? The child goes to the doctor. All they know is they're being picked, pricked by a needle. This is painful. It's unpleasant. Child might say, why is this happening to me?
Why must I endure this evil?
Right? Don't you love me, Mom? Why are you doing this to me? But of course, from the parent's perspective, they can see, look, this small bit of unpleasantness is actually necessary for the child in the big picture.
Because the parent knows better than the child what's good.
Right.
And so this assumes that we don't know everything.
Right.
Okay. There's lots of other possible answers that you will lead us through, but let's take one from a caller, Steve in Overland Park. Welcome to Central Standard. Wait, do we have calls? I'm not hearing Steve on the air. Let me just make sure. Well, I guess we don't have Steve. My mistake. Tell us another of your answers, Susanna.
Yeah. Reinhardt. Well, this is one that I find really interesting, and I've taught this issue several times, and I'm still never sure what to make exactly of this response that I'm about to give, but I find it really fascinating. It's a little subtle, but the response goes like this. One way to pose the problem is to say that, look, a perfect being would create the best possible world, but this world clearly isn't the best, and so that's evidence that there's no perfect being. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's the response. Maybe there's no such thing as the best possible world. Maybe for every possible way the world could be, there's a different way that would be better. So it's sort of like the natural numbers. So think of all the finite numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's no largest finite number. For any number you name, there's always a bigger one. Mm-hmm. So maybe the goodness of possible worlds is like that. Maybe for every world I can conceive of, there's a possible alternative world that would be even better. And if so, then we can't ask God to create the best possible world because there isn't one, right? No matter what world God creates, we would always say, oh, why didn't God create a better one?
Yeah. So this is a way of sort of satisfying ourselves with what we have in a way, saying that this world, though it seems to be imperfect, there's something better. Is that part of what's being expressed in this?
Yeah. Well, the thought is to undermine one premise in the argument against the existence of God. So one way of thinking of the initial problem is, look, God doesn't exist because this isn't the best possible world. God would have created the best possible world. And the response is, no, actually, there is no best possible world, so we can't assume that God would have created the best possible world. So it's a way of undermining the one premise in the initial argument.
I see. We have our caller back, and I think he was not responding because I was calling him by the wrong name.
Oh.
So Dave in Overland Park, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Well, very good, Dave. I thank you for not responding until I called you by the right name. welcome to Central Standard. So how do you answer this question of why there would be evil in a world that we think should be good?
Because we live in a dualistic universe. You cannot have right without wrong. You can't have good without bad. If you do not have the contrast, our brains don't work.
Okay, so let me ask philosopher Susanna Reinhardt to respond to that. What do you make of that we don't really understand what the good is without the evil?
Right. Well, Dave has hit on another one of the sort of classic responses to this problem, which is that you can't have one without the other, right? You can't have good without bad. And I think that's a really promising strategy to explore. One thing to think about, one thing that atheists will sometimes say in response to this is, okay, suppose I grant you that the existence of good requires the existence of evil. But how much evil? There's a lot of evil in the world. How many people do we need to, suffer and die and experience horrible things in order for there to be some good?
Okay, so let me ask Dave. So, Dave, I mean, do you find that explanation satisfying, that's why we have evil? It's so that we can know what the good is, so we can understand good? Is Dave still with us? No, maybe he's using a different name now. Let me ask you then, Susanna.
Yeah.
I mean, you're implying that it isn't an entirely satisfying answer.
Well, I guess given the way the world actually is, I'm not sure I'm convinced that we need all of the evil that we actually have in order to understand the concept of good. right? Mm-hmm. So if the thought is, so again, imagine from God's perspective, God's creating the world, and again, Dave's thought, which a lot of philosophers share, is, well, it's impossible to have some good without some evil. Mm-hmm. So presumably, since God is omnibenevolent, all good, God would try to maximize the amount of good and minimize the amount of evil, right? So mm-hmm. I want some good, so I need some evil, but I want the smallest amount of evil I could possibly have in order to get the most good that I could have. I guess given what we know about the world, it doesn't look like our world was designed that way, because there seems like a lot of gratuitous evil.
Right.
Did we really need as many children as are starving right now? Do we really need for them to be starving in order to understand?
You'd think the first genocide would have made the points about genocide that needed to be made.
Right, right.
Yeah, so maybe that's not the entirely satisfactory answer. Maybe this sheds some light on the question, or at least on one of your earlier explanations. We had some input from Courtney on Twitter. She wrote, "How is perfect being defined here? Are we talking about God as a perfect being or as an ideal human being?" Is that part of what makes this a hard question to answer?
It is, and that's an excellent question. You know, philosophers always like to get clear about definitions, so I'm so glad that Courtney has asked about that. Well, I think typically in the West, theologians have not thought of God as an ideal human being, but the most perfect possible being that could conceivably exist. So really the maximally perfect being. And that's where we get this assumption that God would be all-knowing and all-powerful and all-good. But a different response to the problem of evil is to say, well, maybe that's the wrong conception of God. Maybe we shouldn't think of God as the best, most perfect being that could possibly exist, but just rather as a really good version of a person. And one response to the problem of evil is just to deny that God has one of these three features, right? Deny that God is all-knowing or all-powerful or all-good, since it's that combination that creates the perceived incompatibility with evil.
Right.
So, for example, we might think maybe we should think of God as not all-powerful. I mean, clearly we want to think of God as much more powerful than a person, but maybe we can get out of the problem by saying
that God can't do just anything God wants to,
right?
Which is certainly one theological approach that a lot of scholars have taken, especially in the last 100 years or so, of suggesting that God is still evolving, if you will, in God's own knowledge and God's own abilities. Does that solve the problem from a philosophical standpoint?
Well, it definitely solves the logical problem that I gave earlier, right? Because the logical problem relied on this assumption that God has had these three perfections. And if we remove that assumption, then it does solve the logical problem. Now, whether it solves the problem entirely is a different question, but...
Let's see if we have a caller who might want to weigh in on this. Rich in Kansas City, Kansas. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, this is a great conversation. I thought I might mention one particular answer to theodicy, and I'm not sure whether I'm completely on board with
this. Let me interrupt you, Rich, just long enough to say that you pulled out a theological word we hadn't used yet, but theodicy is really the term for this whole conversation, the problem of evil. Thanks. Go ahead, Rich.
I apologize. And that's the concept of open theism, and it's partially related to what you were just talking about. Part of the premise is that God is all-loving, and that stands in contrast to perhaps some views that see God as necessarily all-powerful. This view would see that God is essentially, above all things, loving, particularly as revealed through the Christian scriptures. And that means then that God must always choose love. Well, if God always chooses love, that involves giving humans freedom and choice, both to choose God and to make decisions. Because of that, that means that God then cannot coerce people to make certain choices. And therefore, because of that, God cannot, by God's nature, coerce people then to not do evil actions. That's to say, you know, if there's about to be a mass shooting, why does God not just immediately cause that shooter then to not shoot those people? Well, because God cannot coerce that person, because that would then go against God's nature as being an all-loving entity. Now, there are certainly some problems with that view, but it does open up some interesting views, especially from a Christian perspective, and at least it helps me to reconsider God as necessarily more all-loving and rejecting some of the kind of the typical the Greek categories of God as necessarily being all-powerful or, as you mentioned earlier, some things like immutability or impassibility, et cetera. I'd love to hear your views.
Rich, you sound like you know what you're talking about. Thank you for the call. I do wonder, Susanna, does this suggest that maybe the philosophical question is being framed in, as Rich said, sort of Greek terms that may not be the only ways of thinking about either God or of evil?
Well, I want to thank Rich for calling in because he hit on what is probably the most popular response to the problem of evil, namely the free will defense. I'm glad I didn't forget to talk about that because that's a really important one. And again, this is a version of the response of saying, well, there are goods that outweigh the evils. So, you know, why is it that God allows there to be a world where somebody is mean to someone else or causes them pain? Well, because it was important for that person to have the freedom of will. And that good, the freedom of will, outweighs the evil that results when people make their own choices.
But then the question might be, why didn't God create people who would make better choices?
That's exactly the question. And there's an analogy here that I find helpful when I think about this. So I have free will, and one of the things that I could choose to do, should I want to, is step out in front of a bus. Nothing is preventing me. I could freely choose to do that, but I never, in fact, do choose that because I don't want to die. So why, we might ask, why wouldn't God make people who have free will, so we retain that good, but who nonetheless have a character that would prevent them from making the choices that would result in evil? And I think that's a powerful sort of rejoinder to the free will response. But I do think the free will response is you know, a great one to think about.
It occurs to me that maybe it's mostly the Protestant reformers who sort of put forth the idea that actually what we're inclined to do is to make the wrong choice, and that truly free will is will that is free to choose the good, that somehow there's a conflict between our nature, or
right.
what maybe the New Testament scriptures would call the flesh,
right.
and doing the right thing.
Right. Well, and here we get into a different really interesting philosophical question about what is freedom and do we have it? So let's take your example. Let's suppose, hypothetically, let's just suppose that someone has a tendency or a disposition to choose wrongly. Does that mean that they're not free? Well, I'm inclined to say that by itself doesn't mean they're not free. I mean, I have sort of a tendency to want to eat cookies. I really enjoy cookies, but that doesn't mean that I'm forced to eat cookies. There have been many times where I've sort of been tempted to eat cookies, and then I think to myself, well, you know, there are all these reasons not to, and I probably shouldn't, and I'm successful in deciding not to. So my inclination would be to say just having a tendency to choose one way doesn't mean that you're not free to choose the other, even if it makes it harder to choose the other way.
We thank you for confessing your sins, sins of the flesh,
oh, well.
Susanna. Let's take a call from Regina in North Kansas City. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I really could appreciate the free will concept. I was calling in to make a comment on that because if you look at it from a belief standpoint, it's either you believe in what we've all been taught to believe or you don't. And if you believe based on Christianity or Islam or any of the other religions, a lot of the principles are basically the same. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And, or like in Islam, ithar, love for your sister or your brother what you love for yourself. And with the free will concept, I believe that God has given us, and when I say God, I mean not in a sense where, you know, you see a person with blonde hair and blue eyes or any human being in that way, just the one who the energy that created life, that creates life, that every day when we wake up, we see the signs of the sun and the setting of the moon and the stars.
I need you to wrap it up, Regina. We're almost out of time.
Okay. I was just going to say that if you look at those signs, I think that the reason why there is good and there is evil is because it's a trial. It's a trial, and each one of us, based on spiritual belief that's innately in us, will have to come to some type of reckoning behind that. And God gives us the free will to make those decisions.
Let me ask Dr. Reiner to respond.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of interesting points that Regina touched on, but one thing I did want to bring out is she mentioned how this issue is common to a lot of different religions. It's not just about Christianity, and that's one of the most interesting things, I think, about this really fascinating problem is a lot of people in a lot of different religions have had to handle it.
Well, there's obviously a lot of truth to what you're saying because our phone lines lit up the moment we opened them. My apologies to Brian and Stanley and Mitch that we didn't get to your calls. I do want to thank our guest, Dr. Susanna Reinard. She teaches philosophy here at UMKC. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Earlier in the hour, we were joined by Dean Kevin Truman and Alexis Petrie in a conversation about the Veterans in STEM program. If you have questions about this or you want to listen to any of our previous shows from Central Standard, you can go to our page on kcur.org. Join us tomorrow as our Cash Money crew comes back to continue the conversation about the sandwich generation and what can be done to prepare for having three generations under one roof. Up to Date is up next. They'll have a conversation with the mother and son who walked across Kansas and also a look back at the 2012 elections. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Claire McInerney and Ross Steinmetz. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.